This is what the corner of 7th Avenue and Sterling Place in Park Slope, Brooklyn sounds like tonight, December 18th, 2013.
But 53 years ago, the typical urban clamor of a neighborhood preparing for Christmas was replaced by the horror of an unprecedented air disaster.
The scene in Brooklyn, New York, like an awful page out of the Blitz which wartime London knew. This is what confronted investigators probing the nation's worst air disaster. The grisly facts have been reported. Now the experts must find the answer, if possible, to why it all happened. The DC-8 jet which crashed here in a densely populated section of Brooklyn was off its course, 11 miles from where it should have been, so the chief of the Federal Aviation Agency reveals in Washington. While no attempt is made to fix responsibility for the crash pending completion of investigations, he says the jet was supposed to have circled in a holding pattern over New Jersey, awaiting clearance to make its approach to Idlewild Airport. Its mid-air collision with a super constellation took the lives of all 128 persons aboard the plane. A boy of 11, briefly, was the sole surviving passenger until he, too, died of injuries. Apparently, six others were killed on the ground when the jet plowed into several brownstones. This edifice, the Pillar of Fire Church, it had stood for 75 years, was crashed into and demolished by the jet. Across the bay in Staten Island at the Army's Miller Field, parts of the ill-fated super constellation were scattered in all directions. Almost miraculously, not a home was touched here. At this holiday season, when homes would know joy, people everywhere share the sorrow of those touched personally by the disaster.
Mr. McGee, don't make me angry. You wouldn't like me when I'm angry.
We hope you like us when we're angry. Hi, I'm Owen Mugen.
I'm Dean Karyanis.
Welcome back to the Angry History Podcast. Tonight we're doing a story that's near and dear to my heart. It's the Park Slope plane crash of 1960. We just heard a very thorough newsreel clip from. That was fascinating. Dean, did you notice that off the top? He referenced the Blitz. That was more Michael Fitzmaurice who did the narration on that, and he referenced the Blitz, and kind of, you got to remember, this was only 15 years after the end of the war, so it was still a legit reference to make.
And that also reminds you of how new jet travel was. Never mind jets in the war, but just the idea of people traveling by jets. And this was the first jet to go down, and it was something very new for people. And this is not a neighborhood. People used to watch the planes fly overhead, as we'll hear in a minute with our guests, but it wasn't as if it's right next to the airport. This was literally out of the blue into a residential neighborhood. At Christmas time, people selling Christmas trees, singing carols, shoveling snow, walking their dogs, and these people were all impacted. Some of them were killed when fire just rained down on them in the form of this plane.
Yeah, just absolutely catastrophic and absolutely shocking for New York City. The neighborhood that this jet crashed into is Park Slope. It's in Brooklyn. It is, you may know of it now as sort of the classic brownstone community of New York, and it's Not quite as mixed a neighborhood as it was. It's fairly affluent when you're talking about the areas immediately on either side of 7th Avenue, which is the main drag. 53 years ago, it was what they call neighborhood in transition, which you'll hear. That's a newspapery term for a crud neighborhood. But this shocked the neighborhood, upended it entirely, and this plane crash became not just a terrible thing to have happened to the neighborhood. It was a for me certainly. Huge memory of my growing up. In particular, I spent so much time in that neighborhood. And as we'll hear in a little bit, our guests have great recollections, which I'd been hearing about my whole life.
And I think for you, this is, you've mentioned it to me a whole bunch of times, but when you have this eye towards history, you can't help but look at a place and see what happened there in the past, if you know
That's about it.
And if you don't know, I mean, when I move into a new house, I mean, I bought the house that I live in now, and I said, well, let me look up all the old news stories. Okay, there was a farm here. There used to be a stream running through, which explains.
I'm sure there are no axe murders.
Yeah, but it tells you everything about it always. And you grew up in this neighborhood now. You had some of your first few jobs right around here. Is that right?
Well, yeah, and I didn't grow up in Park Slope proper. I was born in East Flatbush and lived there until I was 12. And then my folks, we all moved to Fort Greene in 1982, which was a terrific place for us to live initially. Great block, great neighbors, spent a lot of time getting our asses kicked and chased. Park Slope is just on the other side of Flatbush Avenue from where we lived. And I did. I had a bunch of my first jobs here, and probably my favorite and probably the best job I'll ever have. It was in a place called the Gaslight Pub, this old man bar on the corner of Berkeley and 7th Avenue, just a block away from Sterling and 7th, where this plane went down. And it was great. It was $5 an hour off the books, and we were in the small Mexican kitchen in the back, you know, slinging burritos and tacos. And, you know, I was 15 years old. It was awesome.
Was good money back then.
Kidding?
That
it was great.
Great. You were living large.
I was. Of course, though, we'd take the money and we'd go, you know, three blocks away to Soundtrack right off of Garfield Place and spend it on tapes. You know, that's how I built my Led Zeppelin tape collection. So.
Still good to this day. And I have to ask, like, you never worked at Antoine's of Flatbush?
You mean Antoine's of New Orleans? No, I don't mean Antoine's of Flatbush. But yeah, I worked in that old man bar, which is now a Chinese food place. I worked in a gym on Union off 7th. I worked in a video store on Union off 7th. I worked in a liquor store a wine shop. It's Park Slope, after all. A wine shop on 7th off of Garfield. And it was a great neighborhood. It was certainly the one I always passed through. I did a lot of my hanging out in Windsor Terrace, which is further south on the other side of Prospect Park. It's funny, you talk about the history of the neighborhood and keeping an eye toward these things. I mean, Park Slope, we've walked through there together and we've talked about all these things. I mean, General Washington and his troops got chased through here on their way to the East River, retreating from the British. I mean, this is a deep, richly historical part of the city. And of course, just for my own life, quite a number of personal things happened. And this crash, you know, gosh, it happened 9 years before I was born, but man, oh man, was it ever a part of my life and my memory.
Yeah, and it's one of those things too. It really is a picture out of time. You look back at these pictures, especially this boy that we are going to hear more about later, about him being the sole survivor for 27 hours after in the hospital.
Stephen Baltz.
And, you know, it was a sharp demarcation line, as your Uncle Bruce is going to talk about. And that's how those neighborhoods were back then. It was Irish on one side, I believe he said, of 7th Avenue, and Italian on the other. And I know I lived in Hoboken for a while, and I lived actually in the second apartment that Frank Sinatra lived in. And that was on Park Avenue there, and it's right on the border. His mother was Irish. His father was Italian. And they were in the Italian part of town. And then they were, you know, you'd move sort of to the middle and then move your way up to the Irish part. It's like there were pretty clear demarcations. And by this point in time, I think this really must have been something that united people too, though, because your dad was even saying that, you know, we had a hard time after four or five generations or whatever it had been keeping up the animosity. You know, like, who could, like,
tired of just hating each other for no good reason. Well, I look at different parts of the world. No one gets tired of it, I guess.
Yeah, right. But I just thought that was an interesting way to put it, you know, and that's something you can't maybe relate to today, which is a good thing, I guess. You can kind of live wherever you want. So
that's right. And the thing about the Slope, you know, you talk about it in these large general terms about, you know, it was Irish on this side of the avenue, it was Italian on the other side of the avenue. It was still New York. You know, you had everyone sort of dappled in there, but the major thrust of the immigrant population was certainly you know, Irish and Italian. But let's get to what happened that morning of December 16th, 1960, just after 10:30 a.m. in the skies over New York. So we're talking about a mid-air collision between an aging propeller-driven TWA Lockheed Super Constellation, which was flying out of Columbus, Ohio, with 39 or so passengers, two crew. And a new, less than a year old, United Airlines Douglas DC-8 out of O'Hare in Chicago. 77 passengers, 7 crew. They crash into each other in the fog and snow over New York Harbor.
Yeah, they were headed for Idlewild Airport. And if you've never heard of that in New York City, it's because now it's called JFK Airport. And LaGuardia, they were going to two different airports. LaGuardia is, of course, still there. And the air traffic controller, we talked about before the technology and trying to always keep it in mind when we talk about history. They didn't have the ability to judge altitude at this point. And they cleared both of the planes to descend to 5,000 feet. But again, there's no visibility. And the United jet was actually 10 miles from where the pilots and air traffic control thought it was. It was in Staten Island when everybody thought that it was over New Jersey, a ways away. It had taken a shortcut that they had told it to take, the air traffic controllers, nobody had written that down.
About 8 minutes before the crash, New York Central Air Control instructed the jet to shift its path slightly to the north. And what this ended up doing was shaving about 11 miles off the route. And like you said, the change wasn't recorded in the tower. So no one was expecting the jet to get there early. But one controller did try to warn the Constellation that there was traffic approaching from 6 miles and then from 1 mile.
And the jet crashed into the prop from above and behind. An engine ripped through the fuselage of the older plane. So, you know, it's not going to be able to stay in the air after that.
No, no. And the Constellation, it plummets onto a grass runway at Miller Army Airfield in Staten Island, killing everyone aboard. No fatalities on the ground. We'll talk about Staten Island later in the show, which is arguably the neglected aspect of this tragedy.
The United jet was able to continue limping 8 miles towards Prospect Park, possibly going for an emergency landing in the meadow. But it couldn't make it. Instead, it smashed into 7th Avenue and Sterling Place. The pilot's actions, if anything, remain unverified.
Right. It seemed like a good guess that, you know, there was this massive sheep meadow. If you think about it, if you don't know Prospect Park, you probably know Central Park. Same designers. But it was just a massive meadow that a plane theoretically maybe could land on. But no one knows for sure if that's what they were doing. But what we do know for sure is what happened next. The plane crashes into 10 brownstones, destroys the Pillar of Fire Church, and between both doomed planes, 134 people died altogether, 128 passengers and crew, and 6 folks on the ground in Park Slope.
And we should mention again, even though it was in that package, this church was called the Pillar of Fire this happened. And it can sort of sound too perfect. Maybe they started calling it after, but no, that just happened to be the name of it. It had been there for a long time. Yes. And
Old Testament goodness.
Yeah, one of those twists of fate that things just happen.
The guest we were referring to before, who had an actual personal experience with this, are my father, Tom Mugen, and his best friend and one of my oldest friends and uncle, so-called, Bruce Saunders. He was not my uncle. They were just best pals, and that's what you call him. You know, hey, Uncle Bruce. I'm going to call him, hey, Mr. Saunders. So Uncle Bruce and Dad were from this neighborhood. And we're nearby when it happened, and they'll share their story in a minute. But more about Uncle Bruce, and he's a great guy, one of my favorite people. He and his family lived over on 8th Street by the time I was a kid coming up, a few blocks south of where all this stuff happened. And he's just a great guy. He's an insane, crazy maniac and a sweet person and a guy with whom I've enjoyed many hours of great conversation and many years of having him in my life. And to be able to get the two of them to sit down together meant a lot to me, especially with the story that it's been sort of burning to get out of me for quite a while. Before we go much further, here's Dad and Uncle Bruce.
I'm Tom Mugen. I'm 68 years old, so I was 15 years old then. And I grew up in Park Slope, and I live in Fort Greene, which is half a mile from Park Slope now. But Brooklyn's the best.
Bruce Saunders. I grew up at 57 Prospect Park Southwest, which is right on the edge of Windsor Terrace and Park Slope. But I went to John Jay, and at the time I was 15 years old.
And you're related through your mothers or your fathers?
Us?
No, we're not related at all.
No,
we're just the two insane friends.
Yeah, the two insane friends is the operative phrase here. Now, you were in New York with them when they recorded this, and you got to spend a little time. I did this from Los Angeles, but you hadn't met my dad before, had you?
No, I've met your dad before.
Did,
yeah,
we
did that,
Kennedy's.
Irish night. Yeah, that big night at Kennedy's, which unfortunately is another great New York bar that's closed down on 57th Street.
Is it really?
Yeah,
I remember almost all of that night.
Yeah. Well, it was kind of hard to remember things through your tears every time my wife played
Fields of Hath and Rye. Yeah, thanks a lot, Kathy.
But everybody's already heard you cry to that in the last that other episode.
That's right. But you hadn't met Bruce.
No, I hadn't. That was my first time. In fact, that was what I asked him there because you were calling him uncle. And since you're not Greek, I didn't know you could call everybody uncle. And like we said, maybe it's a New York thing, right? But yeah, he said, no, we're not related. So I just assumed, you know, because you could tell when two people have been around each other. I mean, gosh, most of their lives, really, they've known each other.
Yeah. They're both 68 now and they've been pals since they were, you know, 14 or so. Well, let's listen to this interview now with my father and Uncle Bruce that you and I conducted. And then we'll come back on the other side of it and talk some more. Here we go and enjoy this. Dad, how old were you?
I was 15.
You were 15. How about you, Uncle Bruce?
Same.
Okay.
I just celebrated my 15th birthday.
Right. Now, Dad, were you living on Garfield at the time?
Oh, no, no. We were living on 2nd Street, I guess.
Yeah.
2nd Street and 7th Avenue.
Okay, so you were about 5 or 6 blocks away, the house was, from where the crash took place.
Yes, but I was up in school when the crash happened.
All right, now tell me about that. I mean, when was your first inkling that something had happened? Did you hear it? Did you hear about it? What was your experience with this crash like?
The best I remember, I was up in one of the classrooms on the higher floor, and I saw a column of smoke down 7th Avenue.
Okay.
Couldn't tell where it was coming from. It was past the tower of the Dutch Reformed Church.
Okay.
And didn't know what it was.
Now, did someone in school come in and say, you know?
Well, I was a senior, and we started early, and our lunch hour was right about that time, 10 or 10:30 in the morning. So I was going out for lunch when the underclassmen were coming in. And I remember stopping this kid and asking him what happened. And he said, oh, a plane crashed on 7th Avenue. And I said, what, are you a wise guy? You know, it was preposterous. It was unimaginable.
Right.
But that's what it was, yeah.
And you were in John Jay at this point, right?
Yes.
Or Manual, was that what it was called at the time?
No, John Jay.
It was John Jay? Okay. And what about you, Uncle Bruce?
I was in my English class, and I was on that side of the building that we could see the smoke. I was on the 3rd floor, and we heard a loud boom, you know, a loud, loud boom.
Mm-hmm.
And then we could turn and see the smoke. And,
okay.
Of course, you know, nobody knew what had actually happened until we went out into the hallway. And then, you know, people were already saying that, oh, a plane had crashed.
Right.
And I knew I had to get down there. I don't know why, but I knew I had to get down there and see what the hell had happened.
And now, so the school's on 7th and what, 4th? 5th,
yes.
Right? Okay, 7th and 4th. So that's not far at all. It's like 8 blocks all told.
Oh, right. Yeah. Yeah, yeah.
Right. But it's just like you're walking towards, like, hell. You know, in other words, you start to see this, the tail of a plane sitting in the middle of the avenue, and all of this smoke, and you can smell it, and the fire, and it was just like insane, you know, but yet it drew you closer. You wanted to see, you wanted to get as close as you could.
Right. Well, I mean, nothing had happened in the neighborhood quite like this ever. I mean,
exactly.
Right. And to this point, there were only a couple of major high profile crashes in the city. There was the one in 45 of the B-25 crashing into the Empire State.
Right.
But there was also, a couple of years, 3 years earlier, 20 or so people died. Plane crashed onto Rikers Island in 59, the year before. Like 65 people died when another plane crashed into the East River. I mean, do you guys remember any of those?
No, not at all.
No, I don't remember them either.
So, I mean, I read about the one with the Empire State Building, but...
Yeah, right. Exactly.
And that was the year of your
State
birth.
The Empire State Building was famous, but the others, I don't even remember at all.
What was life in Park Slope like at this time? I know the history books say, you know, it's funny, one of the Times, I think, called it a neighborhood in transition, which is another way for saying it was a crap box. I mean, the Slope was not, certainly not what it is now, 53 years ago.
Well, I was 15 years old. I was in high school. I was thinking about what I was going to do. The Vietnam War was starting to escalate. Park Slope was, it's funny. You live there all your life. It's hard to say what it was like. It was like, you know, there's nothing to compare it against, you know. We grew up there. It was a working class neighborhood. 7th Avenue was, as it is now, the main strip. I had a lot of family in the neighborhood. You know, uncles and aunts all down the avenue. I loved growing up in Park Slope.
And Park Slope was a very different neighborhood at the time. It was much more Irish, English, Scottish.
Italian
on the South Slope side, but the North Slope was mostly, you know, English, Irish, Scottish, mostly Roman Catholic with different Protestant denominations mixed in, like I am Episcopalian, there were Presbyterians, there was this really, and
one Jew.
At one time, no, there were a couple of temples in the neighborhood. Well, so well, earlier well, on, there had been a fairly large Jewish area, but that had changed over. And I would say mostly it was middle class, lower middle class area.
Working class.
Working class, yeah. Definitely working class neighborhood, you know.
Well, I was telling somebody the story the other day. When we grew up there, everybody below 6th Avenue was Italian. Everybody above was Irish, you know, for argument's sake. And there was that animosity. But it really had come from the generation, two generations before. And it was tough for us to maintain it because we were in school together and, you know, what was the big deal? And I said, the thing that got us together, the Puerto Rican showed up. So now we had somebody to go against.
Right, and you joined forces.
That's right. I said, that's why this country is great. Yeah. And immigration, we have to keep immigration, or the last guy's going to get killed.
It was a great place to, it's funny, I mean, I spent time there obviously as a kid and had my first, you know, three or four jobs on 7th Avenue. And for me, the plane crash was always something that was there. I mean, you had obviously told us about it as kids and before having had firsthand experience with, you know, an air disaster like a 9/11, just the idea of trying to put one's mind around that a real passenger plane had crashed right in the middle of this neighborhood I know so well, and so many people had died, and so much carnage in this gorgeous neck of the woods. Did the crash resonate with you guys in the years after? I mean, did it become a thing?
Well, it was always something that was talked about because it was, you know, we all experienced it in the neighborhood. To give you an idea, we didn't think much about airplanes then as we did now. When I saw the tail of the plane in the middle of the 7th Avenue, and it looked like it went up almost three stories high, that was the first time I'd ever seen a plane, you know.
Wow.
In life.
Wow.
I'd never been on a plane, near a plane, flying over. I couldn't believe how big it was. It was like a building.
Yeah.
And it was just that. It was just that big tail section. And then you looked around, and the snow was covered with brick and dirt and oil and fire hoses it was bedlam.
I think for me, it was the unreal part. It wasn't even like I was crying or I was emotional.
Right.
Or I was saying, oh, the poor people. It was like, is this really happening? And that was the thing that was so stark to me. Is that this was so much like a movie that you may have seen.
Sure.
But this was there. And yet I still couldn't accept that it was there. I couldn't say, my God, this is horrible. You know, it was just like still amazing to me.
It's shocking when you do think about it, and especially as a kid, I would imagine, you know, coming into contact with that. Now, I know that the neighborhood was flooded almost instantly. Like, they sent like 2,500 rescuers there. Did they start to block you guys off? I remember Dad and you, Uncle Bruce, telling me stories of, you know, turning the bowling alley into like sort of a triage or a morgue. You know, I mean, how much of this did what was happening on the ground and the effort did you guys get to see?
Well, I don't remember what time I got there. I did go right from, you know, lunch down there, and I don't remember what was happening at that point except a lot of confusion. That night, we were in Bruce and I were in the Boy Scouts.
Right.
And we came back, they asked us to help out as volunteers, and mostly it was like serving coffee to the, you know, the firemen, well, what you call first responders. And it was bitter cold. It was bitter, bitter cold. I remember that. I remember walking out of one of the churches where they were making the coffee, and I spilled coffee on my hand.
Mm-hmm.
And before it could burn, it had froze.
Wow.
You know, but it was bitter cold. And people were digging, and like Bruce said, there was a bowling alley down there. It's still there. It's a bar now, a pool hall. And they had the bodies were lying down, you know, the alley, and they were using a lot of the churches around there, you know, for the guys to come in and warm up.
Right.
Around on Flatbush Avenue was the Carlton Movie Theater, which was the big neighborhood theater, and that was turned into a communication center for for all the cops and firemen.
Wow.
And so on and so forth. But I remember seeing people that I knew who were cops and firemen, you know, working there.
Right.
So it was personal.
It became it was certainly, I mean, there's always, the Red Cross always says, you know, a big disaster is at first always a local event, and that seems to be the case here as well, you know. There's a famous photo, and one of the face of this crash was an 11-year-old boy named Stephen Baltz from Wilmette, Illinois, and he was flying in to meet his mom and his sister, who had already landed and gone to Yonkers to visit relatives. He had a cold, so his dad put him on the plane, and, you know, it can break your heart thinking about it all these years now. I think about that 11-year-old boy.
It's a very sad story. I think you're right. That's what people thought about when they tried to make it, you know, when they tried to comprehend it. You know, they thought about that young boy.
Right.
How old did you say he was?
He was 11,
11
when he was killed. Yeah, he would be 64 now, Stephen Baltz. You know, forever 11 years old.
Yeah, the woman who was comforting him, Dorothy Fletcher, was involved in our troop and was dating one of our leaders, this guy Bob Fox. And just the fact that she was there, her own story was amazing. But she lived, where did she live, on Berkeley? Yeah. Just below 7th.
So she lived a block over and down.
Right, and she was the one, there's a picture of the boy being on her lap almost.
Right, which is like got a leopard skin coat on or a leopard skin hat.
Yes,
or
that's right.
Yes,
like that.
Yeah. That's it.
Yeah.
That was Dorothy Fletcher.
It's funny, you know, there's a photo, one of these photos, and we'll put them up on the website, folks, and they're very easy to find, you know, this was a big deal, but there's a photo, and it's so very sad to look at now, this little kid, but there's an older gentleman there, too, and it always makes me think of a lot of these, you know, old Irish guys, like, well, I mean, Uncle Thomas would have been much younger, but it seems like, you know, if heaven forbid, you're in this terrible situation, and you don't have your mom and you don't have your sister and your lungs are seared and you've been in this terrible crash, you know, a kindly old Irish face, I don't know, the thought about that, I guess I tried to comfort this kid more than he actually had in real life, but I like to think that he was given comfort by the good folks of Park Slope.
Well, yes. Dorothy Fletcher, who was, she was the age of our parents. We were kids, we were 15.
Right.
And she was, like Bruce said, one of the first ones around the corner.
Right.
And I couldn't think of a better person to comfort you. She was just a wonderful, wonderful woman. This was a happenstance, you know, situation for her. But when there was trouble, you know, and people needed help, Dorothy was always there. Even till several years ago, she was in her 80s and she was working at the Methodist Hospital as a volunteer. As far as the kind Irish faces, that's all we had in that neighborhood.
Right. Yeah, you let a couple of Italians live on the other side of 7th Avenue, right?
We did.
Yeah.
You also have to remember that she forced your Uncle Jack and I to sing in blackface.
Did she really?
At a senior citizen's home. And your father was the master of ceremonies.
Oh, boy. That, and did you guys have any second thoughts about it at the time?
I'm saving that for
Yeah, listen, we were young, you know, and this was a show that we were putting on and, you know, doing all these songs and stuff. And
sure.
I don't even think, other than having to have to wipe it off my face, I don't think I thought about it in terms of, you know, is this offensive to anyone?
Right.
I was like 12, you know.
Right.
I had no problem with it because I was playing the big white guy, so.
Yeah, that's right.
He was the master of ceremonies, so he didn't have to wear blackface.
I wanted to ask you about air travel and if you'd ever been on a plane before. Our friend Tony, who was nice enough to let us use his home to record all this, he was talking about plane flight in the early days of it, and he took his first flight when he was just 22 and going into the Army. He said Uncle Sam paid for it. This was the first jet to go down in Park Slope, and it had a lot of other firsts. The first black box that was used to determine the cause, the first passenger deaths on a jet, the first jet to go down like this, the first passenger one. One plane was a jet, one was a prop plane. And so I wondered how you related to it. Today, when a plane goes down, I think we all picture it being us. We say, gosh, I just flew through that airport, or I was on that same plane before, that same route. And I just wondered, for jet travel being new then, had you been on a plane before at that point in your lives?
Yeah, no. Like I said, I was 15. I'd never seen a plane in person. So the idea of air travel wasn't something I contemplated doing, you know?
And for me, I didn't fly until the very next year. My brother got married down in Huntington, West Virginia, the next year. So we had to fly down there. But before that, I had never been on a plane either, you know, other than watching them fly over my apartment building. We were in the flight pattern. So, you know,
there were
planes going over quite a bit. And, you know, I do remember that, you know, watching them from the roof.
Well, you know, maybe that says that. I remember we would always pay attention to a plane going over. So I guess it was new, and it wasn't that common. Yeah, you still noticed it.
We all know how a certain scent or odor can bring back a strong memory. I thought of this because Uncle Bruce had said that even to this day, he's walking through Chinatown and the wind will blow and he's back in Vietnam just from the smell coming from the Chinese restaurants. And so I wanted to know what you remember of the smells that day, jet fuel, smoke, that kind of thing.
Bruce mentioned before about the smell of the gasoline, and I don't remember that. But I remember more the visual. The visual for me was, oh, it snowed, and everything was dirty. It was, you know, like snow looks on the second day, not like it does on the first day. And the church, of course, was gutted at that point, and there were just masses of metal and, you know, this big tail. But it was the light that I remember. It was gray, and at night it was dark, but there wasn't all the lighting you have now, it seems. There were a couple of lights. It wasn't like, you know, something happens now and the whole street looks like daytime. Yeah. And the firemen going through and just picking up, looking for bits and pieces.
For me, the overwhelming smell was just that jet fuel. You know, when you smell jet fuel, that's what I smelled. I didn't smell wood burning. I didn't smell any other odors. It was just like this all encompassing jet fuel odor, and as he said, it was like being in the middle of a movie set. So to me, it didn't sink in for quite a while. It wasn't, as I said, my emotions didn't really hit me. It was like just visually, this was like so shocking. You know, just what was going on, that you just, this isn't my neighborhood. This is a movie I'm watching, you know. I'm watching, who is it, did the Ten Commandments, one of these spectacular movies. And it just wasn't sinking in, the fact that this was my neighborhood, that this is actually happening. And I was standing there, I can just remember, it was almost like being numb. It wasn't like I felt emotional and tears running out of my eyes or anything. Nothing like that. It was just my senses were just overwhelmed by what I was seeing, you know.
There's a photograph, or there's several photographs, but there's one in particular. And it was a black and white photo. And it just the disarray of the whole area. It was just a jump. It wasn't like the plane had crashed into a building. But everything was disarrayed, everything was scrap, and it was the snow, and it was just a scramble, like a still picture that looked like it was moving. You know, it was that kind of, you know, madness. But I think the biggest thing was that it could happen, you know? And
well, just seeing the tail of a jet plane.
That's the thing.
Standing in the middle of 7th Avenue. It's just like, this doesn't really happen, you know? Really, it doesn't happen. And
it was huge. I remember that. Yeah. It was just huge. I never imagined it that big, you know, actually, that it could be that big. And most of it gone.
Yeah, there was nothing else recognizable about the plane. It wasn't like you saw a wing lying over here or something else. I mean, other than that, It was just devastation between all the buildings, the couple of buildings that had been destroyed, and bricks and stuff all over the place. All I can visualize to this day is that tail standing in the middle of 7th Avenue.
When we think about this 1960 plane crash in retrospect, we have to go back in our mind through 2001 to get there. Did seeing 9/11 unfold at all bring back that day on 7th Avenue?
Was there a connection? Never crossed my mind. Never crossed, I mean, two events. Till you asked that question. It wasn't the same.
No, not at all. First of all, at the time of 9/11, I was living up in Connecticut. And it was one of these deals where I turned on the radio and somebody, the guy who was on the radio said, turn on your TVs. The first tower had just been struck by a plane, and I turned on the TV just in time to see the other plane come around and strike the second tower. And yet I never related that back to the airplane crash, because it's two different, completely horrible experiences, yeah, but not related in any way, you know? Yeah.
Well, it really was an accident.
Right. Yes.
In every meaning of the word, it was an accident.
Exactly.
There was no, well, why, what had happened, what was going on, who was, you know, it was over.
Yeah. It's just like this train crash that just happened recently where the train was going too fast. Now, we know if there's been terrorist events that have happened in Spain, a train getting blown up. But I didn't think of, okay, that has to be a terrorist event. I said, some idiot just was going too fast, you know? And, and that's what it turned out to be. So it was the same thing with, you know, 9/11 is one of those events like Pearl Harbor that you just can't match up with anything else in your life experience.
It's epical. It's versus, you know, the 7th Avenue was generational. That was our event.
Right.
We'll remember that maybe a little bit on either end of it. But then, you know, like you said, it's like Pearl Harbor or the Alamo or something like that. Yeah. Yeah. It wasn't insignificant in the sense of, you know, personal tragedy and a community tragedy, but it was a day-to-day thing, really. Yeah. It was so many firsts involved. You know, the urban crash, the first death size. You know, how many was 100 and something people died? I mean, that was incredible at that time. You never heard of, that was a big deal. I think the one prior to that was like 30 something people, and 136 people, boom, gone.
Well, just before Christmas too.
Right, and but you see, now that's a generational thing. I don't think that a lot of people say, oh, remember the General Slocum? It's the General Slocum, or the train crash up on by the Brooklyn Museum. What was that, back in the 1910 or something like that? It was a terrible train crash. It'd be like where the Franklin line is now. But it was a big scandal for that generation. And then it's, you know, it goes. One funny anecdote. The guy who hung out, sometimes Irish. His mother lived on the block, and the very tip of the wing of the plane came through her apartment roof.
Wow.
Right? Now, this is the legend. I'm not saying that, but this, the legend, and like that. And she was known for that for quite some time until about 2 years later. She had did come up with the pop-top can. And she had cut a finger on a can of Peel's beer, and she got 12 free cases. And then she was known for that, which was a bigger deal than the wing coming in there. 12 free. All right, what's up with those? I don't know. Maybe she'll give a last name. But,
I'm sure she's done with the beer by now.
She's done by now, yeah.
Do you guys remember how long it took them to clean 7th Avenue up? I mean, when was the scar gone?
Yeah, the only damage on the avenue was the grocery store where the man who owned it was killed, an Irishman. He was selling trees. A friend of my Uncle Thomas's. He was a young man with children. And then across Sterling was a funeral home, and that was destroyed. And the building in back of it was the Pillar of Fire Church, which, of course, everybody made note of the
name,
significance. I remember at one point being over there, people being afraid that the jet fuel was going to go down into the sewer systems and, you know, set the piers on fire, which were, you know, down the bottom. I don't know if that was just scuttlebutt or they were actually discussing that. But after that...
Well, you know...
I'm sorry.
No, go ahead.
Well, after that, I don't remember too much about that corner. It wasn't part of my regular travels. And, you know, you'd get over it. That was out of the neighborhood for us, really. We were on Union Street. That was, you know, the north end of our neighborhood.
Right. Well, I remember by the time I was, you know, spending a lot of time in that neighborhood and certainly, you know, walking with you, we would always comment on it.
Oh, yeah.
We would always we'd get to that corner. And it was, I mean, even to my mind then, prior to 9/11, prior to anything else where, you know, an urban plane crash. I mean, it was just a hell of a thing to imagine that thing being in the middle of that beautiful little, you know, section of avenue.
It was. But like I said, I always mentioned because, of course, I was there and I, you know, had that connection when Bruce was there and so on and so forth. You know, a lot of people knew people. But again, you know, I was driving with one of my daughter-in-laws one day and she's been in Brooklyn for maybe 13 years or so, and we drove past Sterling Place, and I said, a plane crashed there. And just as I got the words out of my mouth, she says, yes, I know. So I would tell everybody every time I passed there. So.
Right, yes, sorry we care.
Well, it was a routine between your mother and your father. They would pull up there, and your father would say, hey, you know, there was a plane crash here. And she'd go, oh, no, really? Oh, tell me all about it. You know, that, so this went on for years. Whether there was anybody in the car or not, he would still do, you know, a plane crash here.
And certainly, you know, I remember we would do this, too. You know, we'd walk past it without fail. And it would be kind of in a joking way. Hey, there was a plane crash here. But there was never any real disrespect involved. I think, if nothing else, we were really trying. It was a thing to remember this.
It was. You know, whenever I've been up in the Methodist hospital, after the Stephen Boltz died, he died in the Methodist, they built a chapel there. And there's a plaque in there dedicated to him, and they have the change that was in his pocket at the time of the crash.
I remember it well. I remember when I was 6 years old, I got attacked by the McHugh's dog, and Cousin Peggy, rest in peace, was working there at Methodist at the time, and you and I went there to get me patched up. And I remember leaving, you walked me to the chapel, and right outside was that plaque. And so I remember at 6 years old thinking about this boy, and it certainly has been with me ever since.
Well, anytime I'm in the Methodist, and it's not that often, thank God, if I'm over at that side of the building, I do go into the chapel and I do take a look at that plaque, and I do remember that boy. You know, like you said, he'd be 64 years old now, and I'm 68, so it was very sad, very, very sad. I think everybody felt that.
Tom Mugen, Dad, Uncle Bruce, Bruce Saunders, guys, thank you so much. It's largely because of the two of you that I have such a memory of this thing, and to share it, at least in our own way, with our audience is something I'm very happy about. So thanks a lot, guys. We'll talk to you later.
You're welcome. Thank you. You're welcome.
I think sometimes when you have one victim, especially one child like this of a disaster, really helps you focus on it. I mean, we talked about the Slocum that's so completely forgotten.
Yeah.
And maybe even, you know, at this point from away from that disaster 50 years later, it was able to be understood maybe a little better. People had metal boats. They didn't have to think about catching fire out there anymore or going down. But this was something we can all relate to, even though it was so long ago. And when you read the stories, all of which were posted at angryhistory.com, you can really hear how and see how this kid was really alive. I mean, I don't think he was typical. I don't think it's the case that he died and now we sort of lionize him. He was a little entrepreneur there. He was trying to breed hamsters to sell to his friends with his cousin. And they said they had a great thing in the paper that unfortunately, supply outstripped demand. You know, he did all some really good things. And his sister, you can see in the picture that she just loved him.
Gazing at him in that one photo, it's so, man. And he did. He seemed like there's a Times piece that we were looking at in our research, and the author made a really good effort to make the boy real again, You know, as you heard my dad say in the piece, and we referenced to it, it's so easy to make someone a symbolic face of something, and then so easy to forget that he was just a real little boy. You know, you can think of all the heartbreaking things, but then you think of all the hilarious and funny things, and apparently he was a cool little prankster, and oh gosh, it's just it kind of chews me up, man.
Well, the family appreciated the fact that when they were contacted for the 50th anniversary, they didn't really want to talk about it. They said they didn't want to keep sharing him with the public, right, as they'd had to. And they said as soon as the Times reporter said, well, I want to talk about him when he was alive, they all perked up and were much more willing to share their stories.
What a difference.
That's how you want to remember someone. And the effect on his parents, I mean, I think it was the cousin or I guess their daughter asked if they ever fought about it. And the mother said only once, because the father said to me, if only you hadn't made him go to New York to visit your family. And I said to him, if only you hadn't switched the
plane. Put him on the plane.
And they just stopped there. And he obviously, father, was never able to get over it. He died not long after, right?
Yeah, he died in 66, six or so years after. There's a lot about Stephen and the woman, Miss Fletcher, who Dad and Uncle Bruce talk about in the package, referencing him. But I just want to get one thought out about, you mentioned it coming out of the package, and Dad had talked about, you know, the Slocum and not having a frame of reference for the Slocum. And he also referenced an old New York City train wreck along the Franklin line, and that was actually the Malbone Street wreck of 1918. And it was a terrible, terrible crash where at least 93 people were killed, and they got rid of the street name, they got rid of the train station. The closest train station it's at now is Parkside Avenue, and if you look at, well, it used to be the D train when I was, I don't know what the hell it is now, Q train, but it's one of those trains on the other side of Prospect Park from where Park Slope is. But you're right, when you talk about airplanes, and that's, again, it finally begins to snap into something about a common frame of reference we can all get behind. The forgotten aspect of this is the Staten Island crash, and it takes a backseat because, you know, debris and human remains did rain down from the Constellation onto neighborhoods like New Dorp and Grant City and on Highland Boulevard. The urban carnage of the Slope crash was just so visceral, you know. But first responders and residents of the island, they live to this day with the unfading memories of extreme horror and trauma on the ground at Miller Army Airfield. 44 passengers and crew members were killed on Flight 266. It was just a terrible day all around. I do want to get back toward Stephen Baltz and Dorothy Fletcher. There was an interview excerpt from the Park Slope Reader I wanted to read. And this was done in 2004 when Dorothy Fletcher was 91 years old. And she actually died later that year. And at the time of the interview, she had a full-time job at Nearguard Pharmacy, which is one of the pharmacies on 7th Avenue. And a buddy of mine used to work in there when I was, you know, one of my many stints on the Avenue. And it's just one of those places you knew, you know. And anyway, this was Dorothy Fletcher's recollection, 44 years later. Quoting now. When I got down there, I saw a policeman, and I told him that I was from civil defense and asked what could I do. And he just said, take care of that little boy. He was a passenger. His name was Stephen Baltz, and he was 8, 9, 10, a real young kid. And the child was so badly burned, I thought he was an African-American boy. His jacket was still smoldering, but he was conscious and was talking to us, and I had an umbrella and opened it and put it over him because the weather was really miserable. Because I'd been working with the civil defense and was a member of the Boy Scouts of America, I knew first aid. I looked at him, and all I could think of was, that child is in shock. There were two men walking by, and I called out to them, do you have a car? Because there were so many people around there and so many automobiles that ambulances couldn't get through, and they said, yes, we have a car. It was on Lincoln Place. We lay Stephen on the back seat, and I knelt down beside him. All the way up to the hospital, he talked to me. What broke my heart was when he asked me if he was going to die. I said, not if we can help it. We're taking you to Methodist Hospital. And he said, that's good, because I'm a Methodist. He also told us that his daddy was still in Illinois, in Chicago, and his mother and sister were waiting for him at the airport. They were going to spend Christmas with his uncle up in Yonkers. It's almost as though he were talking to me now. I can hear him. Up to 3 years ago, Mrs. Baltz and I sent each other Christmas cards and would report what was going on with our families. And then it stopped like that, and I just surmised that she had passed away. To this day, all I can say that there's one thing that always bothers me. I could not save him, end quote.
It's really amazing how their two lives so briefly became intertwined, and she comes across as such a wonderful, caring lady to be there when you're at that stage. You've been so badly burned. And every year until she passed away, the Sunday closest to the disaster, she would put out flowers for the boy. And she didn't even go to the hospital. The reporters tried to get her to go there to see the parents. The parents wanted to thank her, and she just didn't, you know, she didn't want the attention to be drawn to her, which she kind of sensed was the idea, and she didn't want to bother them at that horrible time.
Yep.
And it was really just, she heard the crash, she heard the plane coming down, yep. She'd been in the civil defense, and she said, I've got to go help. Yeah. And
she was homesick or something, she wasn't feeling well, and she decided to just, by chance, right. to stay home that day.
Right, and they were both sick. And that's really what brought them together. That's why he skipped the plane. He decided he would go on a later plane, not fly with his mother, Stephen Balls. He decided he would go alone. His father switched his ticket, and that was just one of those fate things.
That's right. And he did die the next day at the Methodist with his mom and dad with him. You know, his lungs were terribly seared, and he just couldn't overcome his injuries. As we said before, Mr. Baltz died in 1966, apparently unable to recover. As Ms. Fletcher referenced in that quote, Mrs. Baltz died in 2000, and Dorothy Fletcher herself died in 2004. That memorial that Dad references, and we talk about in the package, it includes all the change Stephen had in his pockets, dimes and nickels adding up to 65 cents, and it reads, Stephen Baltz Memorial. Remembering 135 victims of the aircraft disaster, Brooklyn, New York, December 16th, 1960. Our tribute to a brave little boy.
And that was nice of his father to give that to them, to make a memorial. I mean, the whole country, but especially New York City, was really in love with him and following his story and hoping that something good could come out of it. But unfortunately, he didn't make it.
No. And I think, didn't his dad want to have that 65 cents to go toward a fund of some kind to help underprivileged kids? That's the whole thing. Awful.
Yeah. Well, you try to make something good, I guess, come out of it. But, you know, at least we can remember this is part of our whole thing. I mean, you know, there's inspiring stories in history and there's sad stories. But at least we can do is, you know, next time you're walking through Brooklyn or here, Brooklyn, you can at least look around and remember what happens, because it can really come out of nowhere.
That's right.
When your time is.
Well, we thank you as always for tuning in to Angry History. This was, again, one that we wanted to tell for a long time, and I'm glad we were able to. And I want to, again, thank my dad, Tom Mugen, and Bruce Saunders, Uncle Bruce, for taking the time to share their memories with us and to have them saved for posterity. Well, thanks again. I'm Owen Mugen.
I'm Dean Karyanis.
And we'll speak to you next time. Bye-bye.
Visit angryhistory.com to learn more about the topics discussed on today's episode. Subscribe to the podcast on iTunes. You can also like us on Facebook, tweet us at Angry History, or send us an email to angry@angryhistory.com.